Okay, so I'm going to tell you today about a gene circuit in HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, the virus that causes AIDS. And this is a unique circuit in that it's a decision circuit that's monostable. It decides between two different cell fates, but I'm going to show you how it's not a bistable circuit. Okay, so a case in point of what this decision is. Maybe I'll turn off. Which light is this, John?
That's the one over on this side.
Aha, now what happened? Okay, the background of this slide is a cell population that is, some cells are expressing GFP, the green fluorescent protein, in green, and others are not. There's a DNA stain in blue-purple, and there's a cells are stained, their actin is stained in red. But you can see a lot of heterogeneity in this cell population. And you might say, oh, big deal, there's a lot of heterogeneity in cell populations. But if I told you that every single cell in this population was sorted from a single parent, and it has a known characterized integration site of HIV, we know exactly where HIV integrated. So it's an isogenic population with a single integration. Then I think it becomes more interesting about how you get this heterogeneity, this quite large heterogeneity in this population. So that's what I'm going to tell you about. Okay, so here's the outline. First, I'll tell you about this positive feedback loop in HIV, which we believe is noisy. Then I'll tell you about how this noisy positive feedback loop has a stable off state. So that's the monostable part, how you have a monostable positive feedback loop. It's monostable in the off state. And then at the end, I hope I'll get to this, because I really want to tell you about this pretty badly, is how you can use noise, how you can exploit noise as a probe, as a measurement probe, to probe circuit architecture. And how we can tell that HIV is a monostable switch. Okay, so I'll do the acknowledgments up front. The stochastic gene expression and HIV work was done at Berkeley with Adam Markin and David Schaefer, and also with Jasper Ryan and Eric Verdin. I collaborated with a lot. Alan Perelson, I have to thank for teaching me all the beginning stuff I know about HIV, and I worked with him for a few years modeling HIV. Then the monostable positive feedback or turning off positive feedback was done at Princeton with Tom Schenck. And I also have to thank David Botstein, Ed Wingreen, Ted Cox, and Tom Silhavy, who I now work with. And then this final stuff that's not published yet, how to exploit noise and gene expression, was done with Mike Simpson and Roy Dar, who at Oak Ridge National Lab. And these are two of the best collaborators that anyone could hope for. And funding Howard Hughes and Department of Energy and NIH. Okay. So the first question that I want to address is the question of the physiological relevance of gene expression noise. There have been a lot of studies, a lot of beautiful studies, some of them by Alex Van Oudenaarden, studying and characterizing, measuring noise in single cells, in yeast, in bacteria. And we know that gene expression is noisy. We can characterize it in these systems. But the question I think many people had in the early part of this decade was whether it makes a difference, what biology does with it. So does it ignore noise? That's one possibility. Buffer it in some way, or possibly even harness it. And I'm going to tell you about this. Okay, before I do that, a good way to approach this, I thought, was to look in viruses. And many molecular biologists know this, but other people don't. How incredibly successful viruses were in the history of molecular biology. So virtually every seminal molecular biology discovery in the last century was mediated by a virus, mostly phage in bacteria. But some of the animal virus success stories, oncogenes, RNA splicing, actually all of mRNA processing was basically discovered in viruses, in adenovirus. MHC function, recombinant DNA, reverse transcriptase. So viruses are a good model system. Here's the one I'm going to tell you about, HIV. Okay, HIV is a retrovirus, means it's an RNA genome, gets copied into DNA. All Retroviruses are diploid, meaning they carry two copies of their RNA genome. That's these squiggly lines in the middle here. There's a protein capsid in gold, these little gold marks, these little gold circles here, also a protein nucleocapsid. But basically, there's a protein capsid, and surrounded by that protein capsid is a lipid membrane that it gets from the cell, which it bursts out of. And studded within that lipid membrane are the proteins it uses, the receptors it uses to infect the cell that it infects, or the cells. Primarily a white blood cell called the CD4 positive T cell. It's called the T cell because it comes from your thymus, which is a small almond-sized organ just above your heart, and it matures in the thymus. And CD4, there are different types of T cells. The one it infects is called the CD4 T cell. They're essentially the generals of your immune system. They direct your immune response. HIV infects them and kills them, and that's why it's so devastating to your immune system. So it's a very small, relatively small genome. In fact, very small, sorry, 10,000 base pairs. 9 genes, 10,000 base pairs. Here are the 9 genes, and there's one promoter, the long terminal repeat, the 5' long terminal repeat, or LTR. And primarily what I'm going to focus on this talk is the master transcriptional regulator of the virus, TAT. This is called TAT. It stands for transcriptional transactivator. It feeds back onto the promoter and hyperactivates it. So this is a positive feedback loop. And it's the only transcriptional regulator the virus carries along with it. The LTR has a lot of endogenous sequences for sensing its environment, but this is the only viral transactivator. Yes, Denise.
What is a 3' LTR for?
What is it for? that might be a little hard to answer, but there's some details in how it turns from RNA into DNA. And there's a lot of jumping and copying that goes on. So you take this one piece of RNA or two pieces of RNA, and you copy them essentially into a circle of DNA or into a double-stranded piece of DNA. But you don't do that just by copying RNA into DNA, because essentially all polymerases, all DNA polymerases are 5' to 3', so you can't read in the right direction. So what you have to do is read one way, jump over back, keep on reading, jump over back, keep on reading. And when it does that, it copies the LTR onto the 5' end. Or it actually copies both ends. Part of the LTR is on one end, part of the LTR is on the other, and it makes two copies. It's complicated. I don't know how better to describe it. Another reason is for integration. It's a good way to get recombination into the genome by having two copies of the same long-term or repeat at each end. Good question. Okay, so let me give you a little bit of history now about the problem I'm going to study in this virus. When HIV was first discovered in the early 1980s, it infected patients, and physicians essentially saw that patients did not get sick, did not get what we call AIDS, for about 10 years in North America, in Western countries. And you can measure the viral load in patients over this span. So here's the viral load. And for the first few months, there's a peak, and then it sort of settles down. And this wasn't measurable at first. In fact, before we had PCR, they couldn't even measure this. And so they thought the virus was hibernating, thought the virus infected individuals and went to sleep. And then something happened at 8 to 10 years to activate the virus, and people got sick. People got AIDS. That was the notion. But then PCR came along, they were able to measure this viral load, and David Ho and Beatrice Hahn and colleagues were able to do beautiful perturbation experiments on this state called the asymptomatic state, tell how quickly the virus was turning over, replicating, and they essentially found that there was a huge amount of replication going on during this asymptomatic state. This 10 billion virions, virus particles per day per individual being produced. That's the number that people throw around. So there's a huge amount of viral turnover, even though the individual is not getting sick. And I can spend a whole lecture telling you about how people think this works. We don't really know. But
people don't get sick during the initial pulse.
These are when you get typically these flu-like symptoms.
Your immune system is still.
Your immune system is still intact up until essentially here. So this is one of the reasons they used to tell people to come back every 6 months to get tested, because there were times that some of the tests could only detect this region. They couldn't detect you over here. So Yes. Okay, so let me show you about that, actually. It's different than lambda phage. In this case, all retroviruses, in order to complete their life cycle, have to integrate into the DNA. So they reverse transcribe RNA into DNA, and then they insert that DNA into the genome of the host. And from there, it's a gene. And they make copies, they make RNA, protein, they package that mRNA, they go into the next cell. That's how the life cycle of a retrovirus works. I should have explained that. It depends on your multiplicity of infection, on how many virus particles you throw at a cell on average.
Is it a random insertion?
It's essentially random. It's biased, but random. It can go anywhere. About 70% of integrations happen in the 5' edge of open reading frames. But it can't, it's been found, not every single place, but essentially everywhere.
So you can say an average of many copies anywhere.
In on average, in a person, in a person, inside a person's cells, there have been studies looking at that, but you can say on average it looks like one in this state over here because there's very little virus. Afterwards, it's definitely much more than one. So I'll quickly. There is a model that Alan Perelson, a very successful model that Alan Perelson and Martin Novak were able to come up with on viral turnover within this asymptomatic state when virus is turning over very quickly. I won't go over the equations because I'll go over a lot more equations later, but essentially this model considers virus. It infects these CD4 positive T cells, turns them into productive infected cells, and they produce virus. This is the whole model. And they were able to measure many of these parameters inside patients, and that's why it was so successful. Okay. I just wanted to mention that. But things happen very quickly. That's the one thing that this model was good at showing, that things are happening very quickly in the patient. Okay, but that's not the only thing that was happening. So they took patients in the mid-90s. They got these drug cocktails. You've probably all heard of these drug cocktails, a protease inhibitor, a reverse transcriptase inhibitor. And David Ho, in particular, was able to put these patients on these drugs in the first week of infection. He was following patients who had high risk for getting infected, saw when they got infected, and hit them as hard as he could right away with protease inhibitors and all this drug cocktail. And these patients did so well that you couldn't find virus anywhere in their body, in their blood, in their cerebrospinal fluid, in their semen, in their lymph nodes, tissue, anywhere. And these drugs were pretty horrible. So the patients agreed to come off of them because no one likes having flu-like symptoms for their entire life, or even worse. There were these fat redistribution problems where all the fat drained from a patient's face and redistributed as a hump on the back of the neck. It's called humpback syndrome. So patients agreed to come off of their drugs because they thought they were cured. And within a week, virus rebounded to pretreatment levels. So even though you couldn't find virus anywhere in the body by the most sensitive, ultra-sensitive PCR methods, it was hiding out somewhere. That's the problem I'm going to tell you about. Okay, so how do you get these different reservoirs of virus, or how do you get viruses actively replicating and hiding out somewhere? Turns out it's hiding out in the same cells it infects. So one of these, I have to tell you about what a CD4 cell is coming out of the thymus. It comes out of the thymus, it's naive, meaning it hasn't been exposed in the peripheral blood to antigen yet. It's traveling around looking for something to attack. And it's naive, and it's missing a receptor that HIV needs, a co-receptor that HIV needs to infect the cell. When it's exposed in the peripheral blood to antigen, it becomes activated. It has this receptor, and in the absence of any infection, the body has a good way of killing off most of these activated cells, because if you don't, you get an autoimmune disease. So in your body, when you're exposed, when your immune system is activated, most of your activated cells are killed off by the system. But a few of them go into a memory state. And that is the body's way of responding the next time that you get exposed to an infection. So measles, the reason you don't get measles twice is because you have this immune memory. Good example. Okay, so HIV infects these activated cells. And after a short eclipse phase, this is the model I basically showed you in the last slide, you get these productively infected cells. They only last 1 to 2 days. The virus kills them very quickly, about 40 hours, it turns out. They produce a lot of virus. Now, we know the most problematic reservoir of infection was a memory cell. So basically, one of these guys somehow got infected, or some of these got infected, and these are the biggest problem for the reason why the virus rebounded after you took away the drugs. Okay, this is a memory subclass of CD4 cells. They're latently infected. The DNA is integrated. HIV is integrated inside the genome and sitting there and hanging out. It's a very small population. It's established in many cases in the first week of infection, and it's incredibly long-lived. So the very first estimates of how long it would take, watching the decay of this reservoir under drug treatment, how long would it take to completely clear the reservoir? The first estimates were 80 years. Now we know those estimates are wrong. It's probably 150 years or 200 years. So in any case, it's more than enough to ensure lifelong persistence of the virus in the host. Yes, Denise.
I've heard that there are alternative theories about latency. Were there some other tissue?
There definitely are other compartments.
What are the other compartments that people think HIV might be hiding out in? And like, what's the evidence supporting the different theories?
So all the evidence supporting the other theories. Let me tell you the evidence supporting this theory, first of all. You take memory CD4 cells from patients, you highly purify them through multiple rounds of flow cytometry, looking for different receptors. You put them into a dish, you do limiting dilutions, so you decrease the number of cells in each well, and then you activate each well and you measure how much virus comes out. Okay, so that's how you measure these. The other ways, and you do this with other cells as well, that's basically the assay. So it turns out the other cell types are not a type of lysogeny. They're not a post-integration latency. They're the virus hanging out just under the membrane. They're not really inside the DNA. So they're usually called viral sanctuaries. But there are many of these other reservoirs or sanctuaries that exist. This is the most problematic one. This is the one that will last the longest. That is pretty well established in the field. So the question is, how do you get these? That's the question. How do you get these latently infected cells, these lysogens? The first one, that you directly infect the memory cells, that doesn't happen. I can tell you all the biological reasons that doesn't happen. For now, trust me. The next hypothesis, that maybe there's some window as activated cells get turned into memory cells, and as they're turning in, they still look enough like activated cells, but they're transitioning, and they get shunted. So people looked for the determinants of this window. Is it a transcription factor, a hormone, a viral integration site? And the short answer is none of these determining factors are really found to exist. If you are liberal, and not many people believe this, then you can explain maybe 30% of latent clones by integration site analysis. But that's a small minority. You can't explain the rest. No one found a hormone, no one found transcription factors. So the other possibility is that any cell that gets infected has a probability of going one way or the other.
So you have the activated CD4 cell, they've seen antigen, and now they're trying to decide whether they're going to become memory cells or whether they're going to apoptose. Most of them die. Some of them become memory cells.
Sorry.
There's no HIV.
If there's no HIV, this takes like 7 days, 10 days.
So, but HIV can get into the activated CD4 cell.
Right. Only the activated.
Only the activated,
let's say.
One.
Yeah.
And then there must be some probability that it integrates.
It always integrates, or it's basically destroyed.
So if it integrates in a CD4 cell that becomes a memory cell, you have it.
So that's what this was.
I don't understand the difference between.
This takes 2 days. This takes 3 days. This takes 7 days. What I'm trying to say is that if you integrate, and the idea is supposed to be if you integrate that you have productive infection. Otherwise.
And you die.
A memory cell. But this is basically the, what you just said is basically the hypothesis that I had, that maybe if you integrate, you have a chance of going one way or the other, a small chance, but a chance. The other ideas were all that there's some determinant of where you integrate determines. So, for instance, you integrate and you're not producing that well, you have a chance of becoming a memory cell. Let me go through a little more molecular detail and you might understand it a little better. Okay, so here's the, now I have to give you the molecular detail of transcription. I'm almost through the introduction. This is the genome. It integrates into the DNA. Here's my chromosome at the bottom here, essentially randomly. And once it integrates, RNA polymerase comes and binds to the promoter, the 5' LCR. It sits down near the TATA box, transcribes, makes a little bit of RNA. It's actually mostly stalled right here at the promoter. But it makes a little bit of RNA, and the thing that it makes is TAT. And then TAT comes back, goes out into the... It's not working so well. Goes out into the cytoplasm, gets transcribed and translated, comes back into the nucleus with two other proteins called CDK9 and cyclin T1, binds to a piece of RNA that's hanging off of this stalled promoter and hyperphosphorylates the promoter. So this is the idea. The RNA polymerase binds to the promoter, transcribes a few nucleotides, 50 to 70, and since it's transcribed 50 to 70 nucleotides, there's 50 to 70 nucleotides of RNA hanging off. And then if there's any TAT around, the TAT will come back, bind to that piece of RNA that's hanging off, and those other two proteins that it has along with it will hyperactivate RNA polymerase, and then it will take off. Okay? So after you get TAT, you get all the other things. Yep.
So how did you get the TAT in the first place?
Right. Okay. So that is a question that everyone wants to sweep under the rug. Okay? So there are two ideas. One is that this promoter is leaky, and you get a little bit of TAT to start off with. That's probably true. I'll show you some evidence for that. The other possibility is there's some initial condition. That there's some TAT brought along with the virus or made in some way early on that's different than this process. Okay, so that was the big question that no one really wanted to address. and it's an essential question. Okay. All right, so you can think about there being two different states in this transcriptional transactivation loop. One is that if you have a very low activity of the promoter, that you produce enough TAT, a little bit of TAT, but mostly it decays away before it can get back into the nucleus. This is all hypothetical right now. And the other possibility, maybe, this is really not going well, is that you produce enough TAT, it comes back, transactivates the promoter, and you get high activity. So you can make an analogy if you want to, you know, a bistable system where you have the basal state where you have very little TAT and the transactivated state where you have a lot of TAT. So this was partly the idea behind what I was trying to say before. You can integrate and maybe you can, one case you can be in the basal state, the other case you can be in the transactivated state. And that might determine which way you go. I'll show you that's wrong, but I wanted to put that out there. So how do you study this? Now I'm getting to the data. So the way we studied it is we made a virus where we cut out all the bad genes of HIV and just left TAT, the promoter, and then this 3' LTR that we also need. We used GFP as a reporter on LTR activity, essentially. And then instead of making a fusion protein where you fuse TAT to the GFP, we made a transcriptional fusion where these are both off of one mRNA, but they're separate proteins. It's called an internal ribosomal entry sequence. All it means is from one piece of RNA, the ribosome will bind at the 5' end and produce GFP. It also bind in the middle and produce TAT. There are many reasons to use this type of vector. We also use the fusion protein as well. But this one has some nice properties to it. And one of them is it's probably closer to what the virus is actually doing inside the cell. If you flip it and you put TAT over here and GFP over here, that could also work, but TAT is way downstream in the virus. It's not right next to the promoter. So this is probably a better way. Okay, so what you take this virus, you make it, you infect cells. And here's a population of infected cells. You can do this at very low multiplicity of infection, so much less than one virus per cell. So you assure yourself that you're getting a single integration per cell. And then we can look at flow cytometry on this population of cells. GFP is on the x-axis here. And so most of the cells are uninfected, low multiplicity of infection. A few of them are infected, about 5% here. So you can solve Poisson distribution. You can figure out what the actual percentage of cells infected are. And then this is the weird part. This region in the middle here, right, there's two logs of separation between the off cells and the on cells. And this region in the middle, this is the first hint, started fluctuating. Different days, there were different amounts of cells within that population. That was the first hint that there was something weird going on there. And so what we did is you can sort from different regions here and look at the dynamics and see what happens to the fate of a cell or a group of cells taken from one region or another region. So we wanted to look at this region right here. Not advancing. There. Okay. Because this is the region of low TAT expression, low GFP expression. Maybe you're in a regime where numbers, where stochastic expression makes a difference. First, let me show you the control. Take TAT out of the system. Just look at the promoter driving GFP. Make this virus, stick it in cells, see what happens. So here's an uninfected culture of T cells. It's a Jurkat T cell culture. It's a commonly used type of culture. Cell culture. You infect these cells again at low multiplicity, and you get this tail, right? There's some GFP expression. And then you can sort from this region or this region, see what happens. Okay, so you sort single cells and you make isogenic populations. Here are eight different isogenic populations. You sort a single cell, you make it into a population, all from a single cell into a population of daughters, and these are stable for months where they're taken from. Very little variation. Okay? Yes, Denise.
When you did these experiments, did you see a lot of variability in the location of the peak?
In these ones right here?
The open loop guys, yeah.
No. No, I mean, this is really what you see. If you sort from here, you get what you take, where you take from. If you sort from over here, you get the same thing. So what I'm saying is, if you sort from this region, you get cells with a mean right here. If you sort from this region, you get cells with a mean right further along. They're dividing. Yeah. They're dividing for weeks and months. And this has been repeated by a number of people, actually. Okay. So this is very different than what you get. This is a technical point. This is very different than what you get if you do this for a transient transfection. Okay. If you do this for a transient transfection, you get something completely different. This is a stable integration. Yes, Denise.
I think what I'm asking is, depending on the integration site, don't you get really big variations on how...
Most of those you don't see. I'm only seeing the ones which have a decent enough integration site to be actually produce enough GFP. This is a very weak promoter, this guy over here.
Isogenic.
Isogenic.
So they all have the same site.
Okay, so all these have the same... This is isogenic. This is the actual infection. This is isogenic. Yeah. So these have a lot of variation. I can pick from a lot of different places in here. I think it's technical. That's what I'm... Yeah, so I'm showing you here clones.
Now if you sort from a clone population...
I can also do that.
Then you go back to the initial distribution
you took from. So if I sort from this population, I get the same thing later. I can subclone.
If you sort in the tail of
the... Over here? Yes, I go back to the mean here. I can even do something. I'll show you a little bit like that. I can activate with drugs, and they'll turn on. And then if I take the drug away, they turn off. I mean, that's similar. But you can activate with different drugs that activate the LTR. There's binding sites for NF-kappa B in the LTR. So if you add TNF-alpha, tumor necrosis factor alpha, you turn on gene expression. You can add TAT. You turn on even farther. Is there a question here? Okay, so now let's do the same experiment with TAT, with the positive feedback loop. You take this isogenic population, you take an infected population, and you sort single cells from this region of low expression. This infection I'm showing you right here is not clonal. This is polyclonal. But This is clonal. So what I did is I infect a group of cells, I sort single cells, and I grow them up into clonal populations. So I'm showing you the clonal populations here now. Here's a micrograph of a clonal population. You can see a lot of variation in GFP expression. Okay? And we called this a phenotypic bifurcation. It doesn't matter what fancy name we gave it, but you can just see a lot of variation in this set. And now here, if you subclone and take dynamics, things look very different than before. So this was very surprising to us. This was weird. Why this huge variation was going on here. And it's not just an increase in the CV. It's not just an increase in the width of the variation. I mean, it's a very different the moment. The second moment is much different in this case. So we tried to see if we could correlate any of the known biological suspects. So the first biological hypothesis you can have. Yes.
Stable over time.
No. These are not stable over time. No. These look very different as you... Next slide, I'll show you the beginnings of that. And that's the rest of the talk, is the dynamics of this. But the first hypothesis is that this population that's on the left-hand side, that's on the off, not producing GFP, maybe they're just dead. Maybe you did something to them. There's a mutation that happened. They cannot produce anymore. It's a trivial, right? This trivializes the result. So you can easily test that by taking one of these clones and activating it with TAT. You add more and more TAT protein to it and see what happens. It turns on. In red here is a clone. In blue is what happens when you add more and more TAT. They turn on. Importantly for the biological people in the audience, TAT binds a piece of RNA that's hanging off the stall promoter. So it's not a chromatin-mediated restriction process because you've already had transcriptional initiation, right? So it has to be post-chromatin. There's transcriptional initiation. RNA polymerase is sitting at the promoter. So we can rule that out by this experiment. You can also do it with TNF-alpha. Add TNF-alpha, things turn on. So it's not that they're transcriptionally dead. They just decided to be off. But then we started looking for the usual biological suspects that I said. Is it cell cycle? Are these cells in G0 and these bright ones in G2? It wasn't that. You can sort from different regions, do cell cycle analysis, or do the opposite way. Sort from cell cycle regions and do GFP analysis. Aneuploidy. We verify that there are single integration events in these cells. You can do the southern blot, you can do PCR analysis to map the integration sites and figure out exactly where in these clones the virus integrated. And even though there's a single integration site, what if your chromosome doubled? Then you have two copies. That's unlikely that two copies give you a difference here, but it could be something like aneuploidy. We looked at that. It wasn't aneuploidy. Excuse me?
Karyotyping?
No. So the problem with karyotyping, you could do karyotyping, but you can't look at GFP expression at the same time. So there is a flow cytometry method to actually look at aneuploidy, DNA content, but not cell cycle.
All the
chromosomes, yeah. You don't have chromosomes, you don't, but you can tell if there's a difference in one chromosome number. It's sensitive enough, supposedly. People have done karyotyping on this clone, on these clones afterwards. Okay, so integration site analysis, all of these, we really couldn't find an answer in those usual biological suspects. I'll show you the dynamics really quickly, and I'll talk a lot more about these in a few minutes. But essentially, you can sort from these different regions and look what happens to the dynamics. So if you sort from the bright region, they're mostly bright, but they do turn off. And we weren't so surprised by this because people had reported that when you infect with lentiviral vectors, they tend to turn off. I'll show you why we were wrong to believe that. That was a big deal. You sort from this region, they sort of turn on. And again, we saw some turning off. We didn't pay attention to it. Wrong move. And then you sort from this dim region again, this very low expression, and things sort of moved into both sets, both regions. So we really thought...
So how long did you wait after you sorted?
Yeah, so we followed these for many weeks, for a long time, yeah.
And they didn't go back to the, didn't all converge to one type of distribution if we waited long enough?
We didn't wait long enough. We waited for, we had to do a different experiment to address that. But that was really, yeah, they did not converge in these sets of experiments. But I'll show you what was going on. That's really the main point, yeah. So let me show you a cartoon model of, I didn't want to put down the chemical master equation of this model of what we did, but I'll show you the cartoon model of what we tried to see if we could understand what was going on. So take this virus integrated somewhere in the chromosome. You say RNA polymerase binds, produces GFP and TAT, right? That's all we're modeling. Each arrow here is essentially one reaction in the chemical master equation. Then TAT will binds to its factors, come back, activate polymerase, and make more TAT and GFP. This was a simple positive feedback loop that we tried to model. It didn't work. It didn't give us this distribution. That's the take-home message. So we started adding things to it to see if we could come up with this distribution. We know that the protein's modified, acetylated actually, so we added that. Better, but it still didn't work. And then finally what we had to do is add an initial condition of TAT. Initial rate or initial condition. And this was really the only thing that made it work. So we tested, you can see many different models can come out of this. Many different classes of models can come out of this. Showing you the final one that worked when you put some initial condition in. And I'm really only showing you the setup the next part of the talk. So here's the actual the model the simulation of the one that worked. The class that worked. GFP is on the y-axis, time is on the x-axis. And this sort of is what Tim was saying, if he waited long enough. But what the simulation says is happening, if you sort from this region, or if you infect cells at a low multiplicity, many of them turn on, some of them turn off, but they continually turn off. And what you'll get if you take a time slice through here, which is what flow cytometry is you'll get this distribution. So the problem is, this takes a very long time. So they always kind of look like this. And we thought this at first was some bistability or something like a bistability or bimodality at least. It was. So I did that analysis. And we can talk about that more after. The model actually that worked best was not bistable. But that was just a model. Okay? That was just, this model fits better, this one doesn't. So it turns out when you do the sort from the off region, I'm going to show you that in a second, the cells aren't really switching. Right, they only go one direction. Yeah, they only go one direction, and this was the weird thing. You have to do the experiment properly because sorting kind of activates them a little. So. That's right. Yeah. So the reason I want to point this out is because it helped us understand, helped me understand what was going on. That's the only reason. I think it was important. And one of the things that helped me understand was that there was something wrong because it's a positive feedback loop. So I didn't understand how it could keep on turning off. This model, you know, we put in the parameters that we thought were in the literature, but for some reason, it kept on turning off, and I didn't quite get it. I had my suspicions, but I didn't get it. So that this is the next part of the talk. Yep.
Can you tell us what sets this pretty slow time scale of 20 days?
Mostly GFP's half-life, but also the positive feedback. Yes, I will tell you. So the short answer is it's a combination of half-life of GFP, which will pull it down a little bit, but also positive feedback slows things down. Positive feedback will, if you have a transient and you add positive feedback, you'll extend the time of that transient. About 24 hours. That's right. That's right. Yeah, no, Alex is right. Okay, so the cell doubling time is much longer than the cell doubling time here can essentially explain the decay time here. But how long you stay up here, that's mostly positive feedback. That's what I'm saying. This was very old. We didn't understand exactly what was going on. But now things are... I'm going to tell you about how things started to get a little more... make a little more sense. So the question that I really want to address is how you turn off a positive feedback loop. How you get a stable off state in a positive feedback loop. Let me set up the question by saying this is not only a problem for HIV. There's other viruses that also have this problem. Here are four animal viruses which go latent, and their major transcriptional circuits, their master regulators, are positive feedback loops. There's a common motif in viruses, positive feedback loops controlling the entire virus. So HIV, herpes simplex, Epstein-Barr virus, and cytomegalovirus. Okay, they all have positive feedback loops. They all go latent. They all turn off. They're all lysogens. The accepted model that many of you probably know better than I do is to have some sort of bistability. But let's say you have a positive feedback loop with some dimerization, some nonlinearity, for instance. That's one way to do it. Then you can see how you can get a bistability, right? There's some separatrix. Below the separatrix, you're in one state. Above the separatrix, you're in another. Initial conditions can set which regime you go into. Lambdaphage does something like this with a negative feedback loop, bacteriophage lambda. The major transcriptional repressor, called lambda repressor, C1, octamerizes and binds to the promoter driving the other gene. So this is an example of this type of architecture. If you look at the HIV circuit, so take this virus, infect cells, affect the cell population, or a clone, either or take a clone, and then you look what happens after infection. So first 4 days, you can see some population of on cells. 8 days, 16 days, 24 days, you keep on looking at the infection, it keeps on turning off. Okay, like I said, we weren't that surprised by this. But then if you take this population and sort it, take the on cells, they keep on turning off also. And you can do this ad nauseum. You can keep on taking on cells and turning them off. You can do this with a clone also. You take a clone, take its on cells, right? This is a single integration site. You have an on population. It keeps on turning off over days.
Yes, Denise. So
this doesn't prove it, but this to me is very strong evidence against bistability. I mean, this, if you sort, keep on sorting from one region, it keeps on turning into the other region.
It doesn't completely turn it, right? Is there always some?
There's always some, but...
Couldn't that just suggest that there's a big basin around the off, mm-hmm. or smaller around the
off? So the other thing is if you sort from the off, they don't turn on. Okay, I'll show you the other arguments in a second. I think this one is actually the best argument, but maybe not. So you take a control just to show you that it's not something about the system. Without TAT, it stays exactly where it's taken from. I showed you that before, right? So it's not something about this system. It's TAT that does it. Okay. So the next argument is sort of a theoretical argument, and that is that in order to have some bistability, you need to have, on the right-hand side of your differential equation, you need to have some nonlinearity. Do we agree on that? Okay, do I have to do it on the board, or does everyone? Okay. So what you can do is take these cells and activate them with a drug or with TAT. It's coming. And... All right, it's not coming. And then, do single cell analysis and watch how quickly they turn on. Okay? And here is the trajectory for all the cells, for many of the cells in this picture. You can get the computer to segment the image and draw little circles around each cell and quantify how much the increase in fluorescence. And here's the increase in fluorescence. Okay? So one thing is that for the first 8 hours at least, it's completely exponential, right? So that means the right-hand side of the equation is linear.
Essentially, right?
Okay, so This, I'll tell you a little more about in a second, but we thought it's saturated. So you can change this equation to be a saturating positive feedback, but it's still... all I'm saying is that... So you write the equation as tat equals, you know, k times tat. You can have some minus delta times tat also, but it's the same thing, right? Or you can have some k times tat over some a plus tat, right? At very small amounts of tat, when a is much larger, right, then this is basically this. So...
So what do you interpret that as that it's a nonlinear, so it's not affecting the lower bit for something small or something, and then it comes in as well?
So I don't quite understand. If you plot this, for instance, it's perfectly exponential. If you plot this on a log scale, it's linear. How do you get that to...
Generally, if some variables are very small, you often see exponential growth, and then it saturates off.
You have to have some other variable, though. If you do this... That's not true. If you have a Hill coefficient here, if you have some nonlinearity here, this is not going to grow exponentially, even at the beginning. It's going to come under and then go over, or it's just not going to be exponential, right? None. You can do the Western and you see the exact same thing. What's that?
Sorry, why can't it be alpha times tat plus k times tat to the h?
Alpha times tat plus k times tat to the h.
Yeah, then that's linear at low tat and becomes linear at high tat.
Okay, so then you can measure the Hill coefficient of the response.
Look, at the back to the buoy.
Yeah.
So what's the treatment here?
Here you can either add tat protein to begin with and stimulate the loop, or you can add a drug which turns on the promoter, and you watch how quickly the feedback takes over.
What's
in this one, it's a drug. The drug, TNF-alpha. Okay, so even in your case, later on, the nonlinearity should take over, but it wouldn't do this.
It's linear at low tat.
Yeah, but then it would take over to be a nonlinear effect at higher tat. This doesn't do that. Okay. But this is just a saturation. Let me show you the rest. This turned out to be a little wrong. This equation wasn't wrong. I still don't think that you could fit it with.
That equation cannot be right forever.
No, that equation cannot be right forever. This equation eventually, I'm just saying for the first 8 hours, this is linear.
I mean, the argument is to try and prove that it's not by state.
You can't do it with one experiment, is what I'm saying. You could interpret that experiment maybe a different way. But let's look at the next experiment to show that it's really not. There's no cooperativity. There's no Hill coefficient that's greater than one here. What you do is you take the promoter, right, which doesn't have tat, responsive to tat, and you add increasing amounts of tat protein inside the cell. Tat is a nice property. You can add it to the cell culture, it goes into the cells and gets into the nucleus. You can actually take the portion of the protein that does this and attach it to any other protein, and it'll also do it. And then you measure the activity of the promoter inside those cells by flow cytometry, by the mean, and you plot that, and the Hill coefficient is 1. Okay? It is upstream of this. This is not made by the cells. So there could be some you're saying there could be some nonlinearity in the export, not the import, because this goes through the same import. The only thing you could rule out here is that it might be some. I still don't see that argument completely. I have to.
If there's a forced translation or modification of the tat, highly nonlinear.
That could be. I still don't think you can explain the first part, but I have more and more evidence for this. I'm only showing you the beginnings of the evidence.
How do you make the tat constant?
How do you make the tat constant? It degrades, yeah. So what you do here is you take, this is a constant time point, so this is initial velocity, not the actual velocity. So you take 12 hours after you add tat. You take tat time points and you can take 24 hours. Basically, that's the peak of activation. You're taking this at the peak of activation. So I'm not measuring a constant as much as I'm measuring zero change. This is at a steady state, but it's not at a constant.
Can we go back to the last slide? There's something funny about it in that so these DFPs are mean values, right?
These are mean values.
And if it were bistable or even just bimodal for whatever reason, then each one of those points for whatever amount of tat you're adding, you're going to get something like two modes.
But you'd see that in flow cytometry because you're doing the single cell, right? Flow cytometry. This is not the bulk population. You're just doing like a luciferase assay. You're actually taking the population of cells and looking at the mean of each cell, right?
It still seems like a strange measure to me. Because even if it were cooperative,
no.
How would that manifest in terms of the population distribution?
So if you do this with TET, you see something very different. If you do this with TET, you see a nice Hill coefficient of 4, actually, right? There is a region where you get no response,
okay.
And then you have a very steep response, and then it levels off, right? And we know TET is, two dimers essentially binding at the promoter. If you do this with a TET system or a LAC system, you get something very different, is what I'm saying. You can measure Hill coefficients in this way.
Okay.
There's only one peak. Yeah.
Oh, I see. This is open loop. Okay. Experiment was
done
open loop, right?
Yeah, this is what, if you mean by open loop, there's no tat in the response element, then yes. open loop. Then one more piece of evidence that tat is not a dimer, right? So one way you get this is by having dimerization. This bistability nonlinearity is to have a dimerization of tat. That's one way you can get. So what you can do is you can do a FRET-type measurement. FRET is a common technique that people use to look at dimerization, heterodimerization of proteins. You label one with CFP, blue, label one with yellow. When they come close enough, there's FRET exchange, and you can excite one of the fluorophores even with the other one. There's a genetic problem of doing this with the homodimer system, but there's a technique to do homo-FRET with one color. So what you do, you have to do it in the polarization regime. What you do is you split, here's your objective, here's your microscope, your sample, and you take your emission light and you split it with a polarizing beam splitter into two separate polarizations. So you take a look at the parallel intensity and the perpendicular intensity, and there's a simple definition for polarization anisotropy. You can actually derive this from very simple dipole arguments. And it's been measured what the anisotropy for GFP in solution and in cells is. And it's 0.5 in a two-photon system if it's a monomer. We use the two-photon system for other reasons. You don't have to. If it's decreased from that value, lower than 0.5, then you have anisotropy, you have FRET, and you have some dimerization or some multimerization. So here's the control. This is from Howard Berg. We got this TSR YFP. It's the chemotaxis receptor. If you look at YFP by itself, the value is around 0.5. For YFP and GFP are very similar. If you look at the chemotaxis receptor, which is known to form this dimer of trimers, or trimer of dimers, it's very much reduced, around 0.3. And we did many other controls too. I'll just show you this one. If you look at GFP in our cells, it's a monomer. It's 0.5. You look at TAT-GFP fusion protein now in these cells, and this is active. You can add the drug, whatever you want. Still 0.5. And this is not so surprising because TAT binds an RNA element, not a DNA element. So you know you need dimerization or multimerization for binding to DNA, but RNA is very different. Yes?
With any PrEP thing, right, not seeing signal could always be that they're in the wrong place. And
it could always be that they're not, yes, it could always be that they're at 90 degrees or something like that.
I think it could also be that the GFP tag is affecting the dimerization.
Right, so you could also do, people have done this westerns, looking for monomers or dimers. You can also see a monomer. You see a monomer in cells of TAT on Western. This you can do at a single cell level, but not seeing a signal. This is just one piece of evidence. Lack of signal. Okay, so I could. We have a lot more arguments now, and we actually are putting them into a paper because people still don't believe it. It's monostable, but I'm not going to go through all of them. I'm going to tell you what it can be instead of being. I can keep on telling you what it isn't, or I can try and tell you what it is.
Go ahead.
So here's an alternative, okay? And we call this a feedback resistor. Basically, the analogy I like is imagine a pinball machine, right? And this is a special pinball machine in that any time that you lose a ball through the flippers at the bottom, through your flippers, you get two new ones on the table. So it's a positive feedback pinball machine, right? So and the way to win the game is to get zero balls on the table. So if I throw a whole bunch of balls on the table, how are you going to win? It's going to be very hard, right? Because every time you lose one, the table's tilted, balls keep on going through the bottom, you get more and more and more. Okay, so that's the game. Then, so dimerization would be one way to do it, right? You only lose balls if they dimerize through the bottom. That's one way. Another way to do it is make the table really, really, really long, right? So the balls decay away by their half-life before they're lost through your flippers at the bottom. Right, they just disappear. Okay, so that could work if you have a short half-life protein. Measured the TAT half-life, it's 12 hours. That's probably not going to work with the 12-hour half-life protein. In fact, I can tell you it's not going to work. But there's another way to do it. Remember the bumpers on the table where the balls bounce back and forth in between? Right? So the ball hits one, it bounces off and hits another one. You make enough of those and you put them in the right arrangement, like a crescent or something, the ball gets in there and never gets out. It keeps on bouncing, 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 and it can decay away by its half-life before it's lost through the bottom. Okay, so that's the analogy I give to the biologists. Essentially, you can think about covalent modifications and reversible covalent modifications of a protein and getting stuck in here so long that you decay away by your half-life before you complete the loop. That's the model. It's totally equivalent to a non-adiabatic dissipator resistor in an RC circuit. Okay? So what's the molecular bumper in HIV? I told you HIV TAT was modified, acetylated and deacetylated. So TAT is actually the deacetylated form is the form that binds the RNA. It gets converted to an acetylated form by P300, but we also know that acetylated TED gets converted to a deacetylated form by SIRT1, another host enzyme. These are both host enzymes. Okay? So the final piece of data is that SIRT1 is much stronger than P300. So it's biased in the backwards direction. Okay? So this is the molecular bumper, and the equations are actually very simple. This is a completely linear system that I've written down. It's just that you have deacetylated TAT and acetylated TAT. Deacetylated TAT is turned into acetylated TAT by P300. You lose acetylated TAT by SIRT1. You get it back over here. And then acetylated TAT transactivates, giving you more TAT-D. This is the positive feedback rate. And then you have a decay rate for deacetylated TAT. You can put one in for acetylated TAT, but it's all in the nucleus, acetylated TAT. It's very short-lived, and it's happening right on this piece of mRNA, so it's probably not decaying by itself.
It's kind of like a buffering.
This is like a buffering, or you can call it a million things. It's a feudal cycle. It's it's very much like Goldbetter's zero order ultrasensitivity, although it's not zero order, it's first order. But So you can define a very simple, nice thing about this is you can figure out when it's stable at zero. And it's just when the eigenvalues are less than, you know, are negative, that's when this is true. So if I was smarter, I would have seen right away that as long as the backwards arrows are bigger than the forwards arrows, that this is stable at zero. And that's what this is saying here. As long as P300 and the transactivation rate are less than SIR-T1 and the decay rate, this is stable at zero. Very, very simple model. Probably too simple. But it gives you predictions that you can test.
What are the initial probabilities?
So
zero, you get infected, and
so at T equals zero, you have some amount of TAT. Either you add it to the system, or there's some initial condition that the virus brings along with it. You have no TAT A, but you do have some initial level of TAT D. This is basically the basal form. You can think about this as the unmodified form. Okay? So this is what you add to cells in the experiments if you add this to cells. And I'll just draw the phase space. It's a completely linear system, so if you're looking at D versus A. No? That one. So this is TAT A, and let me do it this way. This is TAT B. This is TAT A. The null clines of that are just both two lines. I said zero is a stable state. They're meeting there. And basically, the vector field looks like this, and things are coming along here. But you're starting with the initial condition of zero TAT A and some TAT D, and you take this excursion like that. That's what infection is, or the experiment is. You're always starting somewhere along this axis or somewhere along there. And what you get is some, if you look at TAT A, or if you look at GFP, a GFP reporter, which you put downstream here, you get this pulse of activity which decays away. The time scale is set by degradation and the positive feedback. Right? So positive feedback essentially extends your degradation time. Yes, Denise?
Does this imply that if an HIV-infected T cell can survive 2 days, it should outlive its infection? I mean, do you find infected cells that seem to be getting sicker and then get healthier afterwards?
Okay, so two things. One, that's exactly the question I asked in the second half. But that's not exactly right, because TAT is not the whole story. TAT drives everything else. And the rest of those things are pro-apoptotic, and they kill the cell, the rest of those genes. So
right,
if you would get past the point, yes. Yes.
And it's not dead already.
Yes. Then the hypothesis would be that you could see things surviving.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'll show you that experiment. We did that. Yes.
Why do you start with a lot of TAT?
That's the only thing you start with. If you put in an initial condition of TAT, it's only going to be deacetylated.
Okay. And you need some
initial condition of TAT. Either it's brought by the virus, or some of the viral proteins transactivate the promoter early on, or this is what you add in the experiments. So I'm showing you mostly what I add in the experiments. I can't tell you what is brought along with the virus. I can make correlations, and from the data, from the literature, I can say which ones affect the viral promoter. But I can't tell you for a fact that TAT is brought along.
And what does total TAT look like as a function of time?
Total TAT is always going down. It does. It doesn't go up at first. No.
It only goes down.
Unless you're thinking, unless you're saying before your initial condition. But no, it starts from some initial condition, it continually decays. That's what it looks like.
Last year, because I'm thinking about your earlier mentioned people are treated with the cocktail, and the virus has gone almost smoothly, you can detect it. So how can it come up again after stop the treatment?
Oh, okay. That's a completely... These memory cells are reacting to something in your immune system. So you get exposed. You have a memory cell to measles or a memory cell to common cold. And you get exposed to the common cold. These memory cells activate. So there's spontaneous activation of these memory cells. And when they activate, the virus comes out and starts replicating again. So I'm not telling you about activation. I'm telling you about the initial getting in and staying in.
So the memory cell activate and they generate a lot of proteins to make the initial engineer.
Yeah, so when a memory cell gets activated, it gets transcriptionally overexpressed. The entire cell is transcriptionally activated. So one of the ways to activate a memory cell is by TNF-alpha. It's the same response. Okay. So we can test this one for first prediction. So you take one of these clones, which has this virus in it. You add a 6-hour perturbation of TAT or a 4-hour perturbation of TAT. So it's very hard to see here. In gray is the pre-incubation. You add TAT. A day later, they all turn on. Thank you, John. A day later, they all turn on in blue. And then after that, 3 days, 6 days, 9 days, they start turning back off again. Okay, so this is... You can do other experiments as well, but this, I think, is the strongest, that it's a pulse of activation. Then you can start perturbing this resistor, I call it, perturbing the rates by overexpressing or underexpressing SIRT1 and see if it changes the kinetics and see if it changes the relative distribution in each state. So the idea is if you increase SIRT1, that this should be more likely, and so off-state should be more stable. If you decrease SIRT1, the exact opposite is true. So here's the data. Take a clone in black here, which has very few cells in the on state. You add a drug which inhibits SIRT1, nicotinamide. Cells turn on. Importantly, they don't turn on too far. It's not like activating the promoter. Okay? When you activate the promoter, they all go over here. There's a drug called resveratrol, which is supposed to inhibit SIRT1 in blue here. This is not really statistically significant, this black to blue. But what is significant is when you add nicotinamide and resveratrol together, you abrogate the effects of nicotinamide alone. Yes, Denise?
What does your model, so you can do counter-explain the bimodality?
The bimodality, I'll show you that in 1 second. But basically, if you have this pulse, when you have a pulse, and if the pulse is noisy, and you take a slice through time, you can get a bimodality.
A little distribution going around that trajectory.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but also on that trajectory, that I'm not showing time, so the distribution is little points on that trajectory.
Yeah, a little distribution flowing around it.
Yep. Here's overexpression of SIRT1. So I take another clone, which is on in this case, because I want a good signal to noise ratio, and I overexpress SIRT1 by adding extra copies of it with the retroviral vector. And relative to a control, which is not expressing SIRT1, things turn off slightly. They turn off a lot more when you look later on. But here's the control. It doesn't do anything when you don't have TAT. Okay, so it's not affecting the promoter. And then you can do the single cell kinetics also. When you activate one of these single cells with TNF-alpha, no other drug in black here, turn on at some exponential rate, what I told you about before. If you add nicotinamide and SIRT1, nicotinamide and TNF, they turn on much more quickly. And if you overexpress SIRT1 and add the drug, they turn on much more slowly. Okay, so this is all consistent with the data, with the model. You can do the opposite experiment too. We know, I told you TAT is acetylated, but we know exactly the amino acid residue that it's acetylated on. It's a lysine at position 50. So you can change that lysine to an alanine, remake the virus, infect cells, take clones, and the prediction is, since you've now decreased essentially the effect of P300, because it can no longer acetylate that specific site, that now this is, you've decreased this, this is again more likely to be true. So things should be turning off, right? You've decreased the forward arrows. So if you look at how quickly things turn off, here's a wild type turning off. from the on state, the percentage of cells in the on state goes from 100 to about 90. And the mutant, this lysine alanine at position 50, goes off much more quickly. And then you can do the same single cell kinetics. In gray is the wild type. In green is the mutant. In blue is the mutant down here. But you can rescue the mutant if you add wild type TAP protein to cells, right? So you can add just the wild type protein, and that's the thing activating them. They turn on again at wild type rate in green here. Okay, so now Denise's getting at Denise's point. I want to make one theoretical point. Why would you use this monostable, this linear system, as opposed to a bistable system? If it is monostable. I don't know if I convinced everyone yet. So say you have a transactivator driving a noisy promoter, and by this, I'm really just simulating this equation right here, which is positive feedback, which is saturating with some Hill coefficient H. You have some decay term, and then you have some Langevin term. Okay? This is the equation I'm simulating here. If H equals 1, so you have one molecule activating the promoter, you can find a set of parameters where you turn off, where the off state is stable. You can. You don't change anything else in this simulation now except turn H from 1 to 2. This becomes unstable. And you can do this for a large range of parameters. And the idea is simple. When you have a bistable system, you have some separatrix, right? And that separatrix scales as the root of H over delta over K, times the root of H delta over K. So as you increase H, that separatrix goes down and noise can drive you above it. Right, it's an easy argument. So in a noisy system, if the easier argument is, in a noisy system, you have two states, and noise can send you to another one. So now let me show you the argument that if you sort from the off state, things don't turn back on. And the simulation of what I just showed you in the Monte Carlo simulation, this is really redundant, is just that you get these pulses of activity in this system. They turn on, and then you can see here one trajectory turns off again. Basically, you can have a leaky promoter. It can go above the off state, and it always come back, because there's only one stable state. So it'll take excursions, but it always come back. And if you make the resistor stronger, the excursions just go smaller. So now you can test this in a way by taking single cell sorts from the off state of any of these clones and watching what happens to them. And here's four different subclones. I made a lot, but you can't show all of them. I sorted a cell from the off state here, and I grew it up into a population after a week, and this is what you see. There's leakiness. They'll leak, but they won't turn on. They won't leak into the other basin of attraction, if there is one, as Denise was saying. So I think this is a really strong argument against there being a second basin of attraction. Yep.
Very strong state.
Exponentially.
Yeah. Go back to your simple problem. The model where you have the double activity, you get the side one side back.
Yep.
That will not be the price of the door of the final reality.
I'll show you that this specific won't, but if you put the TAT A part, I'm just trying to argue that a monostable system can, versus a bistable system, will be stable in the off state and in noise when you put noise in. Now let me show you what happens if you put noise into the full model, more of the model. That will give you a pulse. So this is the full model. This will give you these pulses. And okay, so this is a deterministic system where you have a pulse of expression, right? In TAT A or GFP, you have this pulse. So all downstream genes have a pulse of expression in the system. If you, like I said, if you make the Monte Carlo simulation of this system, you'll get these pulses that look like this. And this is the bimodality. This is if you take the time slice here, this gives you this bimodality. Okay, so all of this was to show you that this simple monostable system can give you this bimodality. I still have to think about your argument that if you have linear plus nonlinear, if you can get it. I don't know a good way to test that right now.
I'm quite convinced by your argument. I think you're up against this kind of some sort of cultural memory, because in this field they love bistability.
Yes, they do love bistability.
The simple argument using a linear system is much
much more easy. These are really a simpler
I have another way of testing it. So the last part of the talk, okay, I have 10 minutes to finish the last part of the talk, is one more way to test monostability. That's not the nice part of the talk, though. But keep in mind that this is also a method to test stability. And this is almost an idea. Alex kind of gave me this idea about a year ago. That you could also look at non-linearity and linearity by looking at the noise, the distribution of the noise. But it's kind of the same thing as looking at the rate of increase. Now, Mike Simpson has convinced me of that. okay, so a quick summary of the first part. I tried to show you that there's noise in gene expression and that it may influence a decision. I'm still not sure about that, but that's what we tried to show. I tried to show you about turning off a positive feedback loop without cooperativity, and then the argument about monostability, and the larger argument is that when you have a system which is transient, which is like a lytic infection of a virus, you don't need bistability, right? You kill the virus. You kill the cell. Why do you need to have a stable lytic state? All you need to do is take an excursion into it. Okay, so there's another argument. The last part of the talk is how to exploit this gene expression noise to probe the circuit architecture. And here is the idea. So you have a promoter driving a gene. There is some expression noise. And there's some magnitude to this expression noise. You can measure the variation around the mean for this expression noise. This might be one of your slides, actually, this part of it. But you can also measure the frequency of the expression noise, right? There's a lot of information in the frequency that there isn't in the magnitude. And there are some good arguments about why to look in this axis rather than this axis. One of them is it's easier to scale different levels of expression. Okay, so here's the argument, or sort of how you do it, what you see. You have a system with no feedback, promoter driving just GFP. You'll have some fluctuations around a stable state, and you'll have some correlation time for those fluctuations. So the way I think about it is a pendulum hanging straight down, a ball-bearing pendulum. There's going to be some noise. It's going to be wiggling around the zero state, and you're going to be able to measure that characteristic time where it wiggles around the stable state. Now put a magnet underneath the ball-bearing. And those fluctuations, the frequency of those fluctuations is going to be reduced. It's going to wiggle, but every time it goes away, it's going to get pulled back more quickly. So the correlation time will shrink, and you'll have these much quicker fluctuations. That's negative feedback. And positive feedback is now you flip the magnet over, and you have a repulsive magnet, and it moves around a lot more, the characteristic time. The analogy doesn't work perfectly, but it's close. yes. 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 Yes.
The frequency spectrum, there isn't,
Yes, it can be. But I'm going to do everything correlated. Everything I'm going to do is relative to a control. So I'll show you that we think that we can. We're not looking at each noise spectra by itself. We're looking at the noise spectra relative to a control. So I think that will answer some of your questions. What we're doing is you can build from this trajectory, you build an autocorrelation function. And basically, the autocorrelation function will just decay over time. And the rate at which it decays relative to a control can tell you whether you have positive feedback or negative feedback. So it's a way to probe a system to see if you have positive or negative feedback. And the shift, how far the decay time is shifted of this autocorrelation function tells you how strong the feedback is. Okay.
I don't quite understand this, because if we think about not too high an amplitude for the noise,
yep.
Your positive feedback system can drive you to a stable equilibrium.
Yes. Then you have no positive feedback anymore.
What?
You don't have positive feedback anymore when you're at the stable equilibrium.
Okay, so you will also be perturbing the system in some way to take it away from that equilibrium.
Like, yeah, or you look at the transient. Or you look at the transient. You look at the transient and you normalize the transient to an equilibrium. And there are easy ways to normalize a transient. The easiest way is to add random numbers to it so that everything comes up. And since you're adding random numbers, it's uncorrelated. So that's the cleverest, actually. So you have to look at the transient in positive feedback.
Okay.
That was a technical hurdle here. Okay, So the questions were, well, many people said, well, maybe you're missing something in the whole virus. There's positive feedback, and you were just looking at this positive feedback. Maybe there's another negative feedback somewhere that you're missing. This could also give you this off state being stable, and then you could have a bistability in some way. That's one question you can kind of answer with this, I think. And here's the argument that someone brought up before, that I think you can use a monostable circuit as a switch. And the idea is that if you have this transient of expression, positive feedback basically increases the decay time, right? It pushes you up. And if you kill the cell in 40 hours, I think this is what Denise said, if you kill the cell in 40 hours, then you only have to get to here, right? If your positive feedback isn't strong enough, you decay down below some level and you don't drive lytic infection. So it's basically a timing argument. How long the training it lasts for is can give you a switch. Okay, so
you need to define a threshold.
One, you do need to define some threshold down here. And either there's another circuit, or if you're driving all these other genes which are apoptotic, or not apoptotic, which are necrotic, which kill the cell, then there is they make some nonlinearity. They make, I don't know if I can call it a nonlinearity. You're driving things which are necrotic, but the circuit, the underlying circuit, can be monostable. The upstream circuit, you have to define a threshold of some sort, but yeah, I mean, I have a problem calling the virus bistable because
it's more death.
It's more death. So it's not two valleys. It's a valley and an endless pit. It's a downhill. It's not this molecule. Yeah. This molecule definitely does not kill them, actually. I'll show you that. This doesn't kill them. Yeah, so it's you need to couple it to something in some way. Okay, so the way you do the experiment is you take these single cell, you make single cell movies of, here's a movie of single cells, and you segment each cell, and then you get the expression noise. So that was a 12-hour movie of cells that are not activated, and here's expression noise for all the cells that are segmented in this image, and you build the autocorrelation function out of these cells.
So what's this data?
This right here is GFP intensity from this movie. This is the GFP reporter I've been showing you this whole time, the TAT-IRES GFP, or GFP-IRES TAT. In these cells here, and it's clonal population, isogenic population, and here's the data from a 12-hour movie of these guys. And this is not activating positive feedback. This is just at some low level. T equals zero does not mean anything in this case. I mean, they are decaying at some very slow rate that you can't measure over 12 hours. This is a long time after infection. These are stable clones. Right, and they, if you look over many, many, many days, they are decaying. But over this 12-hour period, it's quasi-steady state. So here's the data looking at these guys. If you look at a non-feedback version without just GFP driven by this promoter, you get some correlation time, some decay time. And you compare that next door to the movie, run them in the wells right on the same microscope, and you just go back and forth between the same wells. You can see the shift, the positive feedback shift, and you can measure how far it's shifted, and the number it comes to is essentially around 6. It increases the 6 with a plus or minus 4 increase depending on when you're looking, but factors of 6. So 6-fold increase in the positive feedback, in 6-fold increase in the decay time. And which translates to a 6-fold increase in positive feedback. The way you do it is 1.5-fold, so it's this one is 2, but when you activate it with a drug, it goes to 2.9 or something. So it's 1 over 1 minus this half-life times this over this half-life.
But I'm a bit confused,
You're really interested in the transcriptional noise.
Yep.
You're looking at GFP. So
yep.
What you're actually, this is being confounded by the fact that the translation of the GFP and the folding of it and so on is kind of smooth out your noise. I mean, it's like
but
a low-pass filter.
I agree, but
it's quite a strong one.
Yeah, you can't look at this number by itself, but comparing it to this one, this is going through the same translation and the same folding.
Yeah, but I thought also the only thing that was diluting the GFP was the cell division. So
yeah.
That's going to be a very dominant process on this thing. So I would have thought that's really
very surprising short maximum issue. Wow.
That's right.
Yeah, 24 hours.
Okay, so the reason is because we're looking at transients. Right, we're looking at 12-hour movies, and the half-life is much, much longer.
Let's see, but you say you've got this huge reservoir of GFP, and you're adding little bits to it.
Mm-hmm.
How can the noise be affecting the transcription and all? You've got a huge bath of GFP, and you're just adding bits to it from the transcription,
yeah,
translation, and somehow the noise can't be due to that, because that's very small, and the noise you compared to the bath, you would have thought. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. It's a bit hard to believe that the noise in GFP is.
I don't know. I mean, yeah,
if you look at the slope, like the derivative, that would be the amplification or not. And then I think we could maybe write a little bit different. The total amount of GFP. The rate that will only accumulate over a time scale of the cycle time. That doesn't fluctuate.
I need to think about this a little more.
Another way is it very similar to with an equal line. What they do is they measure the autocorrelation function of the creation rate. So they take the raw data,
yeah,
and then they take the slope.
So they took the first derivative. I didn't know they took the correlation times. The closest thing is what Aurea Lund did. They really did look at autocorrelation times in Aurea Lund's paper. And they got numbers that were a little bit longer than this, but not much longer.
Were they using destabilized GFP?
No, they weren't. They were using GFP within the context of a...
Very hard to believe. But they divide faster.
No, they don't divide faster. Those were also 12-hour, 15-hour dividing cells. Those were fusion proteins, yeah. So they probably have shorter than a 48-hour half-life, but they don't. And many of them had long half-lives as well. Yeah, no. So I actually talked to Alex Segal about this, and theirs are a little bit longer, you know, 2.5 to 3 hours, but not that much longer.
Well, I remember when Mike in his paper said that he said the intrinsic noise of correlation time is basically 10 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
The extrinsic decay time is this cell lifetime.
Yeah. So they were looking at bacteria. But that was very different. They weren't looking at the correlation, autocorrelation function in time. We can talk more about that. But
autocorrelation in that figure. This is not the first one. It's a science paper.
Okay. It's getting too technical. So let me just get to the main point. So in this case, you can also measure the transient, how long it lasts for. It goes to about 30 hours, where it's increasing. So if you look at the derivative in this case, it is still non-zero at 30 hours, 35 hours. So this is driving a long time transient. So that 12-hour little, there was some drug effects on 12 hours that were doing something, but 12 hours is not when it saturates. Okay, that's one thing about the last piece of data. Second thing is you can do the same overexpression experiment, decrease positive feedback strength, and you see it move over the other way. Okay, so it's moved back in this direction. And then if you activate cells and you sort them from the transient, see how quickly they decay away. You can see that when the positive feedback is strong, the transient has a much longer lifetime. So I'm doing everything relative here. I can't say anything about the total number, about the actual correlation time full number. Okay, then the thing you can do with this system is you can do the whole thing in wild-type virus. Okay, so you take a wild-type virus, One of the genes, NEF, this I think is the most exciting part, actually. You replace it with GFP. Since TAT, REV, and NEF are alternative splice variants in the same piece of RNA, you're basically reporting on TAT again, but not with the fusion protein. So you're alternatively splicing either TAT or GFP. So you can measure from this one how strong the correlation shift is compared to just promoter-driving GFP. And you get essentially the same shift. It's a little stronger in some cases. Okay, so again, an isogenic population, you infect a cell, you take single cell clones, you do the same thing with this virus. Okay? And then you measure the rate of increase. For this virus, it keeps on going well past 40 hours. If you actually do the flow cytometry, because it gets technically challenging to do it here, it goes well up to 72 hours, might be before, somewhere between 40 and 72. And then you can see how quickly this kills the cell, because this actually does kill the cell, right? And you can measure the half-life of infected cells. And that's about 40 hours. So it's going past that time. And then finally, what you can do, again, another relative correlation, is overexpress SIRT1 in this full-length virus by adding extra copies of SIRT1 to the cell retrovirally. Again, decrease the feedback strength. And so here's the full length, and here's added SIRT1. And then do the experiment that essentially Denise was saying, where you sort cells that are turned on from the transient and see how many of them 5 days later are off. And here's what the SIRT1 increase, and here's full length. So there are some cells that turn off again, and if you decrease the positive feedback, you can increase that number. So again, everything I'm doing is relative. Okay, so then this basically was the most... The kicker, that we were able to bias this decision between these two states with changing the positive feedback strength. And of course, we did many controls as well. But that this was basically it. I'll leave you with the teaser that you can think about a therapeutic strategy for increasing, overexpressing SIRT1 in these cells and driving cells towards latency instead of them turning on, and try to halt AIDS, but not cure a patient. Just make sure they don't go into AIDS, or try and bias them not to go into AIDS by turning all the cells into latent cells. And my wife named this virus the latency-enhancing optimized retrovirus. And, thanks for... That's it.